Good evening. You're listening to WICN 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. So nice to have you with us. You know, for many people, of course, you know, and many of the people here at the station, and of course, family, friends, and relatives will tell you that Al Voner is the last person you want to see in the tech industry, because it wasn't something that I was weaned on. But many generations since that time have found high tech to be the draw, attracted to big industries, attracted to the high tech industry. In hopes that they would find the opportunity to be creative, to find advancement, and even a welcoming environment, and of course, a great pay. Those are the hopes, those are the wishes, those are the things that many people enter high tech are looking for, and many times it does pan out, but it's not always what it seems to be, and that's why we've invited my guest this week, author Claire Stapleton. Her new book is Don't Be Evil. And the book, Bad Bosses, Fake Promises, and My Escape from Big Tech. So for the next half hour, we'll be talking to Claire about the book and her experience with Google, one of the big tech firms across the globe today. Claire, nice to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Al. Great.
Correct me as I did that introduction, talking about young people. They're not just young people. I mean, people who love technology, creativity, the opportunity for advancement, the opportunity for a welcoming environment. You hear about these extraordinary salaries and how inviting the tech industry is. How accurate is that versus the reality?
Well, I started at Google in 2007. I went straight out of college, and I felt like I'd won American Idol getting a job there. I mean, Google was, always wanting to be the cutting edge of technology, and certainly, at that time, Gmail was pretty new. They just bought YouTube. Google Maps was roaring. Google Search, of course, has sort of transformed how we navigate the world. But if anything, I think Google was sort of selling its new model of a corporation. And so I was an English major. I wasn't a coder. I wasn't someone who was even particularly tech savvy, but they were bringing in a lot of young people into these sort of gorgeous campuses, flush with perks and all this great free food. And the idea and the sort of philosophy was, if you kind of nourish your workers, really take care of them, then they are going to be these rock stars who will change the world with their, innovation and the teamwork and all those other things. So it was, there was a lot of hype. And, early on, as I kind of dug into the campus, it really was a kind of amazing place to work, back then. But I think, over time, the company has become just a much more typical corporation. And the book is really about, my journey kind of navigating a career in a changing company in a changing world in the tech sector, but also a company that was just struggling to live up to that hype and live up to those ideals.
And the first of all, I want to ask you, you were based on the West Coast at that time, correct?
I was in Mountain View, yep, in headquarters.
And I had been out there recently, and just so for the audience, click, you know what I'm talking about. But as she said, just beautiful, the vistas, and you go on campus. It's like, oh my God, this is another place, another time and place.
Santa Cruz Mountains, it's 72 and sunny the year round. I mean, it's amazing.
Exactly.
In a lot of ways. It is kind of a promised land.
Well, and I guess, as you said, that's quite a lure, especially for someone interested in entering the tech industry. So I'm not saying that this was purposely designed to fool people, because I think, any company, any industry, in order to survive, needs talented people. And you use whatever draw you can use. But it sounds like all the things that were promised, all the things that they were selling over time, once you got in and once you spend some time there, you'd find out, as you said, the bottom line is we need to make money at any cost. Is that a little too harsh?
Right. I think that the company just became so big and bloated and complicated. And really, Google's business is online advertising, and the growth engine and all the incentives really kind of come back to that. But I think as the leadership changed over time, Google became, and this is true of all the tech companies, they had, even as they got pretty big, they retained a startup feeling. And I think that the leadership really loved that because it kept things exciting and it kept people innovating and doing all these interesting things. But ultimately, the tech companies have become infrastructure, and these are the institutions that now kind of run the world. I think that the company has gone through a lot of growing pains, and people today would say, yeah, sure, there's still some free food and there's still, a lot of kind of smart, interesting people. But, this really does just feel like any old other big company. And that is kind of a tragic turn in an actually relatively short, decade and a half from all the promise, because Google also said from the beginning, when the company went public, we're not a conventional company and we don't intend to become one. And, it feels a lot like a conventional company these days.
Yeah, I don't work in the high-tech industry, but I've heard that from friends and cohorts that, are closer to the industry or have a hand in that industry, that at the end of the day, you got to make money and it's got to get the company to grow. You've got to do the things that other companies do. Claire, let me ask you, and I don't want to make this a sexist issue at all, but I got the sense back, as you said, when the industry was just starting to unfold, that it was a very welcoming environment for women. Mm-hmm. Was that the case for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's books about the bro culture, a startup culture, back in the Valley, and the guys sort of coding in the garage, and engineering is typically pretty male dominated. But Google, again, was so thoughtful about every aspect of its sort of, workplace philosophy and HR. And, I think that they really did make a big effort for it to be a very kind of fair and equitable environment, whether or not, that everyone would agree with that or felt that, because I think there's lots of biases and these sorts of things that, come into the work environment. But I certainly, as a young woman, I had a lot of responsibility, early on. I felt like there was a lot of room to kind of advance and grow. You're kind of a self-starter. There's all these kind of big and interesting projects going on, and which was a function of the company having, a ton of revenue and growing really fast, so that, they were able to sort of pay people well, give them big opportunities. That was quite an amazing experience.
I want to continue along that line, but I just want to take a quick pause to remind our listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. My guest is author and labor activist Claire Stapleton. Her new book is Don't Be Evil, Bad Bosses, Fake Promises, and My Escape from Big Tech. And we're talking about one of the largest and most successful high-tech companies in the world, Google, and the experiences that Claire had during her tenure there. Again, going back to some of the things we talked about earlier, okay, so they, full promise and an environment that felt comfortable for many people, regardless of where you are. But here's the thing, as I stand on the sideline, I'm thinking, okay, you said it yourself that you weren't necessarily groomed as a, as a coder or someone in the real technical aspects of the industry, but yet they saw, your writing skills, your communication skills, which are certainly still to this day vitally important to any organization, getting the message out there. Did you ever get a sense that they put levels of worth on various employees based on skills? In other words, as you said, coders are those people that are
Okay. Everybody would say at the time that, engineers are the kind of first-class citizens because, their output was the most critical. I don't know if that's still the case, as AI seems to be able to do more and more of people's jobs. But yes, at the time, I was in, being a communications person, PR person, that's a service, a service around the kind of tech power center. And, Google, like a lot of these big tech companies, is ruled by the engineers and product folks. But, you know, you're, as an executive that I knew used to say that when the spaceship lands in your backyard, you get on. And the kind of idea of Google at the time was, it doesn't matter what your role is, you're contributing to this sort of world-changing project. You know, this is civilization building. We're going to solve humanity's problems. That because the company wrapped up the sort of technology project in all this sort of moral language, it actually had quite a religious overtone. You feel that, you know, every kind of cog on the wheel is imbued with a bigger sense of purpose. Sort of a unique aspect of the company at the time that I think is, you know, harder to sustain, you know, as people have you know, started to become a bit more skeptical of tech, the company becomes more corporate, more bottom line oriented. And, you know, so all these shifts are sort of happening over time.
As you talked about earlier, prior to going public, and I'm sure the revenues were still quite healthy prior to that. Of course, you know, you do go public, and you know, you've got people invested in that, but you've also got a tremendous amount of money now to work with. Did the sense of going from a private entity to public, did that have anything to do with change in attitude?
Yeah, I mean, I got there in 2007. The company had gone public in 2004. So, you know, I actually feel like it's remarkable. It still felt sort of like a startup, and you know, they're adding, you know, hundreds of people every week and all this. It was like growing like gangbusters, and yet still had a sort of youthful spirit. I mean, Larry and Sergey were just in their early 30s, you know, when I got there. So the founders of the company who were running it were quite young. You know, I think that diagnose in the book is that it was really actually a few years after I got there that the company became so big that it actually sort of ended up becoming this holdings company called Alphabet. I mean, it's Google, sort of the, you know, household name, but they own so many companies and so much sort of data and infrastructure of the world kind of pumps through Google that I think it became harder and harder for them to hold on to that, you know, one team, one dream. You know, it's an organizational psychology issue, I think, over time, but it's sort of remarkable that they managed to have it feel so small and sort of like all interconnected, even after, you know, the sort of financial event that made, you know, a big percentage of the company, you know, millionaires, ten times over, billionaires, you know, a lot of people made a lot of money. I think that one thing that was going on at that time, and now is sort of, there's a mirroring with the AI race, but a lot of the young people that I met there were, you know, kind of chasing the next pot of gold. You know, Instagram was a new company then. Facebook was, you know, eyeing going public. Twitter was big. Square, all, you know, there was always sort of a shiny pot, you know, at the end of the rainbow in Silicon Valley, if you want to be, you know, going through an IPO and all that kind of crazy stuff. But Google was sort of, again, trying to offer something different, which is, we have this huge vision, which, you know, as Larry Page, the founder of the company, would say is, you know, we have all these resources and we sort of owe it to the world to solve humanity's problems. And, you know, he would talk about curing death even. So he was talking big, you know, this is, you know, years after they'd gone public, but saying that, you know, we need to keep, not only, you know, do we, you know, want to contribute to the world this way, but these are the kinds of problems that will keep Googlers, you know, it's so invested in this company, working so hard, giving to so much of the company. So there were a lot of different, you know, I think, vectors of the rhetoric at that time. It was very interesting.
You said something earlier that certainly resonated with me, and that's the fact that startups, regardless of the industry, in this case, obviously Google and in the high tech, you have all this promising ideas, and everybody's, oh, that would be great if you ever put something like that into play. Wow, I'd come work for you, and this, that, and the other thing. And as you said, the dream of working for Google. But then, as you said, one, they go public. Secondly, now they're buying up competitors. And then, well, today anyway, AI is becoming the new,
new shiny thing.
Yeah, and you know, just to survive. So what I'm getting at is, you know, Larry Page, Sergey Brin, you know, the founders. I wonder if they sit, you know, if you had one on one with them right now, they say, look, it wasn't our wish to change philosophies. But you get wrapped up in this industry and you find out that you're either going to eat or you're going to be eaten. In other words, you know, you can't let the competition be, beat you, so you do whatever you can to survive. I'm just wondering, like I said, any.
Oh, yeah.
So obviously, the money, the competition out there had a lot to do with this change in philosophy, right?
It gets really complicated. And I think that, you know, again, with the strange fate of these tech companies that, you know, rule the world, is that, you know, the people who founded them were kind of like for the love of the code. You know, they were technologists and geeky hackers. And then all of a sudden you wake up and it's 10 years later and it's like, you know, you're a state power, basically, the amount of influence and power you have. So, I mean, I think it would be really interesting to hear. I mean, I think Larry Page hasn't been, you know, seen since 2018 or something like that. He's completely, I mean, he's probably still, you know, a big part of the company, but, you know, to the outside world, quite reclusive. And, you know, I think that Sergey is really invested in this AI race. But, you know, it's funny with the tech industry because the stakes are high, surely, but they always make the stakes sound bigger and crazier and, you know, world historical. I was just reading a book called Empire of AI, just to kind of learn about all the cast of characters in the AI universe, which, you know, is like Elon Musk is in there. And there's all sorts of, you know, crossover from the, you know, the earlier years of tech that I knew. But everything is like, it's so existential, you know, humanity's on the line and the robots are going to take over and general intelligence. I mean, it's familiar to me because I think that, you know, in maybe a slightly different scale, I think Google, you know, was sort of pumping the employees with, you know, these are kind of world historical stakes as well. And it really does a number on your psyche as a kind of worker, you know, when you feel like you're going to war every single day or something. It's like, you know, it's quite intense.
Yeah, I mean, just listening to you, I'm going, you know, I don't know if I could, you know, work in that kind of an environment. Not to mention, Claire, the thing that, you know, has been around since the founding of the earth, the creation of mankind, egos. You start off as a humble, you know, I get it, you know, Larry Page, I'd be in seclusion too. I mean, if I had, you know, today in this world, you know, if you've done extraordinarily well, you know, don't go buying yachts and, you know, first class airline. There's just so many things that people will poke fingers at. And, you know, you say, I didn't expect this to happen. I just wanted to do well by the world and at the same time be successful. But what I'm getting at is egos play a big role in the changing of values, the changing of ideas and philosophies. Did you see that shift as the company grew?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I think that my book is, you know, I really was interested to think about, you know, the kind of the changes of company culture. But one of them certainly was Google having the age of executives. Before, you know, when I first started, it was like everything was, the company's so flat, good ideas come from anywhere, young people can come in and just start, you know, contributing. But as time went on and the business got more complicated, then you end up with these, you know, functional areas with a big exec, sometimes hired from the outside or from Microsoft or, you know, kind of a, more of the grown-up in the room. Those people get tremendous resources. They get a chief of staff. They get their own PR person. And, you know, one of these executives that I was doing kind of internal speech writing for, who was a sales executive, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg, the big ego or the fact that he had a fleet of people running around anticipating his every move, his every mood, you know, and, you know, kind of, I think it really affects how you relate to other people, how you see your own humanity, you know, so it's just like, you can kind of understand the human nature is that you really lose touch with normalcy as you kind of become a big executive. And Google, you know, was just separate from the kind of, you know, the power and notoriety someone might have within the company. You just, you're so vastly wealthy all of a sudden, you know, your life changes in all these different ways. And, you know, the compensation packages at the top of Google are just simply jaw-dropping. I mean, there's people making hundreds of millions a year there. Jeez. I mean, it's really crazy, you know, and so I think that all these things have a profound impact on culture. You might talk the talk about it being a startup feeling and good ideas come from anywhere, but, you know, when you have someone getting paid a couple hundred million at the top, that's a tone, right?
And I have learned from an early age, and I certainly didn't come from wealth in any way, shape, or form, but money changes. I remember family members saying this, money changes people. And I said, how can money change somebody? If you work hard and you get compensated, what's wrong with that? But it does. It does change people. And it sounds like, you know, that nurturing environment, that welcoming environment, the one that allowed for creativity when you entered Google, completely did an about face. Did you know, people that you worked shoulder to shoulder with, you know, cohorts, right within your department, did they get the same vibe? I mean, were all of you starting to feel, hey, this isn't the same company we, you know, when we started?
That started to happen, and there were, I think, some, you know, rupture moments, and certainly the Google walkout, which I played a role in organizing, was sort of this moment where the rank and file was sort of saying, hey, what, there's a gap here between the company that, you know, we thought we were joining and the experience that people are having here. But I think that more what happened is much more mundane, which is that the company politics were intense. I mean, I was in, you know, I moved from the communications department to the marketing department. Again, and sort of just these organizational dynamic shifts, Google got really invested in its own image. So all of a sudden now they're putting lots of money in brand campaigns and social media and, you know, building these big teams. And what was rising to the top, you know, from my point of view, and we talked about this a lot, you know, in the break room, so to speak, was that the people that were rising the ranks were the savviest kind of game players. They weren't the people where, you know, as a young person, you're saying, oh, that person's actually the sharpest, you know, strategic, creative mind here. That person just knows how to manage the executives and knows how to argue for, you know, more budget. But the job, you know, started to feel a bit more like BS, you know. And so I think that also, you know, kind of that contributed to certainly my own sense of disillusionment, sort of like, I don't even feel like I'm contributing to anything here, you know, much less the, you know, company's vision of, you know, improving humanity. And I spent the last few years of the company at YouTube. And YouTube is, you know, it's a really, you know, interesting canary in the coal mine of a lot of the issues that we've seen with, you know, social media and these content spaces, you know, having a lot of really tough consequences on society, right? You have influencers who are encouraging teenagers to do dangerous things. You have, you know, child predation, and
right,
you know, I would, you know, get a briefing every day that would, you know, say all the kind of, you know, really kind of tough things that there were headlines about going on, you know, on YouTube.com every day. But meanwhile, my job has always been to be kind of a cheerleader and a booster, and we were really invested in the narrative that YouTube is having this, you know, kind of beautiful positive transformation on society, and people are building businesses and we're connecting humanity and all the stuff that's sort of familiar. We kind of roll our eyes at all this sort of, you know, kind of democratizing information language about, you know, the tech industry. But those two things were really challenging for that team, you know, of just, we're seeing what the kind of ugly reality of things that go on social media every day. But then, you know, we're responsible for kind of covering that up and, you know, and saying it's all kind of sunshine and rainbows and dogs on skateboards.
You know, Claire, that's so interesting that you said that, because today I hear this, regardless of age, you know, look what's going on. Did you see that influencer was murdered, or that person started an organization and is recruiting young people to do this and do that and horrible things? And, you know, if it weren't for, you know, if we didn't have this technology, these things wouldn't happen. It didn't happen in the 40s and the 50s and so on and so forth. The point I'm getting at is that in spite of that, in spite of those arguments, in spite of those frustrations, we're locked in. We've been, the carrot, the proverbial carrot has been waved in front of our, I can't imagine anybody, in spite of how much they say they dislike high tech and the way things are today, the 24/7 news cycles and everything is out there. You know, Facebook, you can post anything you want for pretty much. I don't see anybody saying, I'm done, cutting it off and walking away. I'm sure there's those few cases, but we're kind of like, we've created our own monster, have we not?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, someone was circulating a presentation at Google, it's like a long time ago, you know, 10 plus years ago. But it was all about the dangers that were coming with the attention economy, you know, it started off as the, you know, for all these tech companies, but really Google, you know, as the forefront, that it was all about information, right? That information will make the world a better place. But then Google and these companies started profiting off of people's eyeballs because, you know, YouTube.com is free. I mean, you can buy, you know, ad-free version or whatever, but, you know, it's the algorithm was getting really good at keeping people coming back for more. And it's very savvy at getting people to, you know, the autoplay and getting people to click, and the relationships that young people are developing with the influencers that they follow is very, very close, and in ways very dangerous, because, you know, it you know, the influencer could be an irresponsible young person who's you know, saying neo-Nazi stuff, or, you know, or encouraging them to jump off a cliff. You know, I mean, it's you know, as much as, you know, YouTube would try to have rules around these things, and we're going to, you know, ding these accounts that, you know, break the rules, it was really tough, because the bigger and bigger the audience is, the harder it is to enforce punishment or, you know, anything. You know, it's really, really tough to, you know, manage all the content moderation and all these other things. They're difficult problems. It's really like the genie's out of the bottle, yeah, you know, yeah. with, and particularly because the model of the company making money is actually about people being on the site. You know, it's like Instagram. You know, how much can Instagram rein these things in? Because ultimately, that's what they're doing to make money, right?
Exactly.
Keeping people on the site as long. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, as we start to wind down, at the end of the day, and you're exactly right, there's tremendous amounts of revenue coming in. And if you see that, and it's the lifeline of your business, you're less likely and much more reluctant to make any changes in there. We've only got a few moments left, so let me ask you real quickly. Have you turned your back on high tech? Would you ever go back to that industry?
People often ask me if, you know, what are my tips for getting off of Google and, you know, divesting all your information and all that. I'm like, I got Google Photos with my kids. You know, I'm like, you know, I'm still in Gmail. I mean, whatever. You know, I think that, you know, tech is a really, you know, consequential industry. It does sort of like rule our lives, for better or for worse. It's something that I've, you know, become like quite interested in. Can I imagine getting another marketing job at Facebook? No.
Right.
I don't know if anyone would hire me after, you know, kind of being outspoken about some of these issues. But, you know, I think, you know, my book also follows that you kind of never know what the next chapter is going to be. And sort of like, you know, I threw my hat in the ring of tech. So it's sort of like, I can't imagine I'll ever fully divest myself one way or the other.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned the book again, because it is Don't Be Evil. Great read. Bad Bosses, Fake Promises, and My Escape from Big Tech. My guest has been the author, Claire Stapleton. Her experience in the high-tech industry and the changes that she saw, and the good, the bad, and, you know, the quote, the Clint Eastwood movie, The Ugly, I guess, in many cases. Claire, real quickly, if people want to reach out to you directly, is there a way they can do that?
Yep, I'm on Substack under my name, Claire Stapleton. I run a newsletter called Tech Support, and I look forward to connecting with people about the book.
And again, the book is widely available. Don't Be Evil: Bad Bosses, Fake Promises, and My Escape from Big Tech. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN, 508-752-0700. Or you can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you so much for tuning in. ¶¶